In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
What went wrong in January when an aircraft went down at Ellsworth? From SDPB, today is Monday, July 29th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson reflects on the culture at Ellsworth Air Force Base and the path forward to regaining the nation's confidence after a scathing public report. We will also talk about progress on a new farm bill. Then U.S. Senator Mike Rounds weighs in on the farm bill from the Senate side, where progress is slower. Then Denim steps from the stage and back into our studio for a look at his musical summer, plus 150 years of the W.H. Illingworth photographs. We'll explore the impact of an archive later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A report from the Air Force Global Strike Command says weather wasn't the only factor in a B-1 crash at Ellsworth Air Force Base in January. U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson says the details of the report alarmed him, but the fact that South Dakotans have access to the information is the American way. I spoke with the congressman on Friday. We talked about what's next for Ellsworth. We also discussed a new farm bill for America. The farm bill advanced out of the House Agriculture Committee. Here is my conversation with Representative Dusty Johnson.
That report was hard to read. I love Ellsworth. I love the airmen, but it was really harsh. I mean, it identified more than two dozen human errors that contributed to the loss of the aircraft, which also could have been a loss of life. And it was just amazing. They really found a widespread degradation of airmanship skills. And I think this needs to be a wake-up call. I think the good news, I think two pieces of good news. Number one, in our country, a free country with a free press, we get to find out about this. And that means we get an opportunity to have it be a wake-up call. In authoritarian regimes, this would obviously be swept underneath the rug, and we wouldn't have an opportunity to get back to excellence. We all know Ellsworth is absolutely capable of excellence. And we're going to get there again, and this incident is going to be a wake-up call, pushing us in that direction. I think the second piece of good news is just that we do have an opportunity to get better. And so often in our lives, we get wake-up calls. Sometimes those wake-up calls are because, you know, we go bankrupt, or you know, we have a friend who dies, or, and I don't want to say that the loss of a $500 million aircraft isn't severe. It is. Mm-hmm. But we've managed to get this wake-up call, and frankly, at just the cost of an aircraft, which I think is going to, I mean, we need these bombers to be ready to defend freedom. And doesn't look like they're quite where we wanted to be, but this incident's going to push us in the right direction.
Yeah. Are you seeing anything that tells you how to move forward? Because I'm seeing really broad things, you know, a culture of noncompliance, widespread deviation from established policy and procedure, several organizational influences and preconditions. Those are big sweeping criticisms. How do you begin to recover and get back to some kind of position of strength?
You're right. It was broad. I mean, as you know from reading the report, I mean, there was equipment on the runway, measuring equipment that hadn't been working for 2 months and nobody knew it. We had the airman who mishandled the throttle process when the wind shear picked up. We had somebody wasn't wearing the right safety gear. They weren't paying attention to the visibility notice. That wasn't included in the pre-flight training in the briefing. I mean, it is kind of a dizzying array of errors, and yet it all comes back to the same thing, and that is, I think, and we've all had this happen in our lives. Maybe you're a freshman in college, and you start out with the best of intentions, and I'm going to study every single day from 3 to 5 p.m., no matter what happens, and I'll study more than that, but for sure that block is going to be sacred. And then over time, you're getting okay grades, things are going pretty well, and so you let you get a little soft, you get a little loose, and things start to creep into these hard and fast rules that you set for yourself. And this can happen to all of us. We think there are too many regulations and there are too many rules and too many procedures, and I don't have to do it that way. You know, I can go 5 over on the interstate and I'll be fine. And I think ultimately all of these things that we're looking at, they're all tied back to that there was not enough adherence to the rules. And this is going to be the biggest wake-up call in Ellsworth Air Force's recent history. And I think it is, we're going to see a much better adherence to the rules, the process, and the procedures.
Yeah. They are getting ready to be the future of the strategic bombing fleet with the arrival of the B-21 Raiders. Does that, in your estimation, has that contributed to that? Do they have the staffing that they need to be doing this mission with an older aircraft? Do they have, is there focus in one place and then they lost focus in another? Because, as you said, these are good airmen, hardworking people. We have a lot of confidence in them. I don't want to criticize from the distance at which I sit, especially. However, do they have the support, the funding that they need to have the operations that are safe and that do recover from this black eye, really?
Yeah, two data points I would share with you, one that I don't think you should put too much weight on, and the other I think you should put a lot of weight on. The first is when I have been on base and when I have gotten briefings, I see a continued commitment to the B-1 Lancer as a platform. I do not think they have moved past it. I mean, I still think they understand how incredibly important this aircraft is. Don't put a lot of weight on my observations because I'm not an expert. But we have this really detailed and a report that does not pull punches, and it did not identify the assumptions at the heart of your question as a problem. And I think we should have a lot of faith in that. I think if they had said, gosh, these guys were too interested in the B-21, they weren't interested at all in the B-1. I mean, I think had that been the case culturally, the authors would not have hesitated to say so, because I think they were very frank and very earnest. And again, I want to reiterate, I mean, thank goodness for a free press and an open, transparent American government, because there are dozens of countries in the world where a report like this would absolutely have been swept under the rug.
Yeah. All right, let's pivot now and talk about the next farm bill and your involvement with it, some of the South Dakota priorities and updates that you think need to happen, and where you feel like we're at in the process. Where do you want? There's a lot in here, so I'm going to kick it to you and say, where do you want to begin with some of the priorities that South Dakotans would really want to hear about first from you?
Yeah, I'm one of the 6 subcommittee chairmen for the Ag Committee, and in that way, I helped write the Farm Bill, and it is a good piece of work. You don't need to take my word for it. It passed out of committee on a strong bipartisan vote. You know, the Senate is a little behind us. It's not unusual for that to be the case. It takes 2 to tango. We're getting closer to the end of the year. I still am hopeful we can get something done before the end of the year, but I don't want to kid around here, Lori. I mean, I'd feel a lot better if this was May and you and I were having this conversation rather than knocking on the door of August. It's going to be real hard for us to get this done by the end of the year. And if the Senate hasn't released any text yet, much less passed it out of committee. So they've got some work to do. As far as priorities, the House Ag Committee passed Farm Bill is really good for South Dakota. I mean, my top priorities, if I would quickly walk through 5, number 1, I wanted to make sure that the risk management tools were improved, things like crop insurance that farmers can buy. We wanted to make sure that we better accounted for inflation, which is obviously very different than it was 6 years ago. Number 2, we need to be building capacity in the cattle markets outside of the big 4. I've been the foremost House champion for that, and we got a couple of really important provisions in the bill that addresses that. Number 3, conservation. When we talk about conservation, we often think about idling acres in a program like CRP, and that's got some value, but this farm bill really makes an investment in working lands conservation so we can do things on those functioning ranches and farms that help with water quality and soil health and habitat. Number 4, let's open up some more markets to American ag products. We've got the best corn, beans, beef, dairy in the world. People are loving. They really want to buy it. Let's not make it hard for them to get their hands on it. And I would note, Lori, I mean, just for little old South Dakota, it's $5 billion a year we're selling overseas. That is $5,000 per South Dakotan every year that's coming into the state. We would be much poorer if those markets weren't giving us their money. And then finally, we are $35 trillion in debt, and I wanted to make sure that we, as we invested in those priorities I just mentioned, we did find savings in other parts of the Farm Bill, which we did. This Farm Bill does not spend more money. I think it just prioritizes it in a more appropriate way.
All right. Obviously, it's an election year, and part of what slows things down can be an election year. But you've built a groundwork and a framework. You don't have to start from scratch after November. Tell me, now that we're looking at a possible, it seems the front runner here is Kamala Harris for the Democrats, and Donald Trump is the nominee after the Republican convention. Both bring strengths and weaknesses for farmers. Clearly, you're Republican, so we know kind of what side you fall on. But some people are concerned about Donald Trump at tariffs, and they remember the trade war with China, and even the farmers who were supportive of the president at that time had a difficult time enduring the level of that, you know, the impact of some of those decisions. As we hear the candidate say, hey, we need 60% trade, you know, tariffs on China, 10% on everyone else. And what you just said about opening markets and the amount that we sell overseas, help us hear what you think about that part of Donald Trump's platform and how that would impact South Dakotans.
Well, and just to double down on kind of the concerns, I mean, it's not just one political party that is more market skeptical than they used to be. It's both of them. I think both candidate Harris and candidate Trump are, listen, they're candidates in a more populist time than we were in 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. And so I do think for those of us who understand that the trade is an incredibly powerful machine, engine powering American excellence. You know, we've got our work cut out for us. We got to explain to people why this makes sense, why this makes us richer, why it makes us safer. And, you know, Bob Lighthizer was the trade ambassador under the last Donald Trump presidency. And Lighthizer and I talked with some frequency, and there was a lot we agreed on. I mean, I think there are some things we can do in a targeted way to try to change China's behavior, the Chinese Communist Party. These are bad dudes and ladies, and they are working to undermine American excellence. Broad base, I mean, big tools like blunt tools are not going to get done what we want to get done. Tailored and focused tools will. And so I'm hopeful that's where we'll end up as we have these conversations.
Yeah. Another big difference between these two candidates is the way that they talk about conservation. And both of them do talk about conservation, but there are significant differences in how they speak about it and presumably how they would govern. When you talk about conservation, I wonder if you would go back to a little bit about what you said about working lands and expand on that so that we can have a broader understanding of what that would mean that would be different than what we're seeing right now.
Sure. And where this, and if I had to give you one policy debate that really encapsulates the two different views of the party, would be this. The Inflation Reduction Act made a substantial new investment in conservation. It also took many existing conservation programs, and it said, okay, to qualify for this new basket of dollars, you have to have carbon as the centerpiece of what your conservation practices are resulting in. And listen, we need to be good stewards of the environment, at the same time as we want to make sure that we're doing right by carbon, I think we also want to acknowledge there are lots of conservation priorities that maybe wouldn't score out on that metric, but would do a really good job of habitat or of soil health or of water quality, and that was a big fight in the Ag Committee. A reason a number of Democrats voted against the Ag Committee bill was that they did want all of those conservation dollars to flow kind of single-mindedly toward carbon. And I just got to tell you, I know we think we're so clean in South Dakota, and it is a beautiful state, but the surface water quality in this state and the surface water quality in much of America is not as good as we think. And on any given summer day in South Dakota, there are notices that say you should not be swimming in the Big Sioux. You should not be swimming in Lake Mitchell. You should not be swimming in the Vermilion. And I think we have got to get better and smarter at understanding that conservation can provide a suite of benefits rather than checking every box before we work in a partnership with that producer to get it done.
Yeah. Any final thoughts? I know you're sending out some emails or press releases today about tribal, some efforts you've been working on for Indian country. Anything you want to leave with us regarding some of those things? They look interesting to me. I haven't dug deep into them yet, but.
Yeah, as I've met with tribal leaders, they are single-minded. And every time I meet with any of them, they tell us that the federal government is falling short of our trust and treaty obligations with regard to public safety. And they know that there is more that can be done to keep reservations safe. And I have been banging that drum back in D.C., and it's a bipartisan message. There are 574 different federally recognized tribes in this country, and almost every single one of those tribal chairmen or presidents would tell you that public safety is an issue. And so we did get a very big win this last week. We are able to increase federal funding for tribal law enforcement by 34%, kind of an unheard of level increase. It is much needed. We were able to find dollars for that investment by cutting other parts of the bill. Because we're not an environment where you can just spend more and more and more. We got to spend smarter and wiser, and we were able to do that earlier this week.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Before the break, we talked about progress on the Farm Bill with U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson. Now let's check in on the U.S. Senate. Here's my conversation with U.S. Senator Mike Rounds.
Unfortunately, I can tell you that there's not a lot of movement on the Farm Bill, but let's get into it, and at least I can share with you what I do know about it.
All right, let's talk about why there isn't a lot of movement, because the concern is it's because it's an election year and we're waiting, but that's maybe not the answer farmers want.
It's probably not the answer, but I think you probably hit on what is going on. You've got a couple of things all kind of coming together. First, you've got the House, controlled by Republicans, who have passed a bill that has about 75% of it going into nutrition. You have a Senate bill that has probably closer to about 80% of it going into nutrition. But you've also got a Senate bill which has, first of all, a committee chairman, Senator Stabenow, who this is her last year. She's retiring. So she'd really like to do a farm bill as part of her legacy. At the same time, Republicans are thinking that they may very well be able to get a better deal in terms of their interests, making improvements in some areas of the Farm Bill right now with regard to the commodities under the Farm Bill, the Title I stuff, as opposed to more of it going into Title IV, which is nutrition, or Title II, which is the conservation parts of the Farm Bill. You've got a disagreement, and it's a philosophical disagreement between Republicans and Democrats as to where the Farm Bill should have its emphasis this year. And you're talking about $1.5 trillion being proposed to be spent over the next 10 years. And so the real argument is probably spread over about $20 billion in the bill itself. Mm. And Republicans are saying, well, now these are the folks that are on the committee. Some of them are saying, well, we going to get a better deal for farmers if we wait until next year and do it under a different administration. And you've got Senator Stabenow, who would really like to get something done this year, but she wants to put some more money into the carbon-based conservation areas and into the nutrition parts of the program. So it's an honest philosophical discussion going on between the two parties. The question is there perhaps a chance after the election, so after we know what next year looks like, to actually have the two sides get together and say, let's find a compromise and get something out this year rather than next year. We also know that the Farm Bill is due to the extension that's currently in place will expire on September 30th. So sometime, I believe, in September, before the 30th of September, there will be an agreement to either send this to the end of the year or into next year. And that'll be based on whether or not both sides think there's a chance of getting a compromise put together after the election, but before the beginning of the next year.
Yeah. A couple of criticisms have been leveled against the Biden administration, particularly from
some environmental working groups who say there are a lot of subsidies intended to sort of build out the science of reducing emissions in the ag industry. In other words, you know, farmers are being paid essentially or subsidized to do some unproven practices that would mitigate climate change. And the criticism is, if we don't have the evidence that those things work, why are we funding them? And of course, the other side would say, well, we're funding them because we need to find out the science and get it into scientific literature. So some of these chances have to be taken now in this way. So I'm curious, when you look at those things, what level of evidence do you want to see about effectiveness in climate guardrails before the expenditures? Where do you fall on that philosophical line?
We know that farmers do a good job of stewarding their land to begin with. We also know that there's a real concern about carbon in the atmosphere by a significant part of the population. I think there's an opportunity for ag to profit from holding keeping carbon out of the air. You can do that with some farming practices, but what we got to remember is that farmers are also really concerned about having stable pricing with regard to commodities, and that can't be overlooked in this either. You can do both. The question is what's the split between the two? And the other piece of this that we have to remember is the most significant part of the entire farm bill has nothing to do with production. It has to do with nutrition, which is the former SNAP program, which is at a minimum 75% of what we're talking about. And, you know, as I share with people, you've got about 9 states in the United States where you actually have cows that outnumber people. And because of that, that means you've got a total of 18 senators that are focused on the actual farm bill itself in terms of productivity and to some degree conservation practices. But the rest of the folks that are out there that have an interest in agreeing to spend this money are interested in the SNAP program or the nutrition program, including, you know, school lunch program as well as SNAP. So it's a matter of trading back and forth where the money's going to go and how much of it, even though it's called a farm bill, how much of it is actually going to go to farming operations and making for more stable farming practices long term. It's hard to answer your question as to where I stand on it because my real focus is making sure that we've got a safety net in place for farmers. And if we're taking away from that safety net to do experimentation on carbon practices, then I've got a problem. If you talk about actual farming practices that I'm convinced really do work, such as conservation reserve program, or in being able to plant more trees, I've got a real interest in that because I think farmers have an interest in that, but not to the loss of the safety net. And that's going to be the key, I think, is can we get some of those resources that right now have been reserved under the Senate bill under Senator Stabenow's idea about it with regard to, you know, something to do with conservation versus what I think are the critical areas, which is making sure we've got a good safety net in place. If we can resolve that, the farm bill is going to move forward.
You mentioned those 9 states, and we think about the importance of cattle and dairy in South Dakota, but that's not the political majority. So also from some environmental agencies who have pushed back and said the real solution is less dairy, less meat consumption, which would be wildly unpopular in South Dakota for most voters, of course. However, that's the landscape that we're moving into where the rest of the country is looking at the emissions from ag, which are not as high as the emissions from transportation, for example, but are significant enough to be concerned about. So how do you move forward in that landscape?
Part of it, I think, is explaining to the rest of the country that, chocolate milk doesn't come from brown cows and meat doesn't come from the dairy case. It doesn't come from the meat case. It comes from actual production agriculture. And I think that's part of the process that we have and part of the challenge we have is letting people know that you have to have a vibrant ag economy if you're going to feed not only the United States but feed the rest of the world as well. And, you know, this is one area in which we actually produce every single year we actually create something every year, and it's food. And if you don't want stable food prices, then there's a real misunderstanding, because I think, you know, if you look at even the political environment that's going on right now, one of the things that's really been an item of criticism of this administration is the fact that prices have not been stable, and that affordability is a huge part of that. And in fact, when you take a look at just grocery prices, they've risen over 21% in the last 3.5 years. People see that. And, you know, when they go to buy bread, when they go to buy milk, when they go to buy beef, hamburger, and so forth, they see these rising prices. If you want to bring the price of food down, if you want that stability, you've got to have a safety net for farmers. So part of the message that we've got to be able to send to consumers is, number one, affordability means a stable or stability in pricing for farmers and ranchers. Their ability to know that they're going to be able to pay their bills at the end of the year if we have a drought, just as an example. But also, it's the quality of the food that they expect. You know, we talk about having a farm bill in which we actually tell the consumer where their food comes from, and it's truth in advertising on what's in the meat shelf or what's on the meat shelf. Do you want beef that's being produced in a country that doesn't follow the same safety standards that we require here in the United States? You know, where's your fish coming from? What about the production of the products themselves, the plants that come in? You take a look at where we have our bacteria problems and so forth, and where is that coming from? Is it coming from a different country? Do we want the production of those to come from other countries and be dependent on them for our food supply? And at a national security level, the answer is no. We want to make sure that we've got a good, solid, stable food supply system here in the United States. And that means having a safety net for these farmers and ranchers, or they won't be in business.
You've been, Senator Rounds, a big advocate for country of origin labeling. Do you think there's room for that in the next farm bill? What are you hearing the traction for that would be?
I wish I could tell everybody out there that I knew for sure it was included. Mm-hmm. Most of the parts of the farm bill have not been released yet, so we don't know whether they're going to include it or not, or whether or not, if it's not included in the base bill, if we're going to get a chance to actually propose it. If we could have proposed an amendment, I think it would pass in the Senate, and I think it would pass in the House. The question is whether or not, the folks that don't want the American consumer to know where that beef is coming from, whether or not they've got the power to keep it out of a committee-designed bill. And I don't have an answer to that yet, but we continue to press members that, you know, this is important to the American people, and it is workable. To allow, all we're asking for is that our negotiators, when it comes to amendments to our trade policies, that our trade reps, that they be required to include mandatory country of origin of labeling as a part of our negotiations with both Mexico and with Canada. We can't just simply legislate it and say it's got to go into effect. We have to negotiate that into our trade agreements. And that's what we're asking them to do. And that way, then, it would withstand a challenge in international courts as long as it's part of our trade agreements. Mm-hmm. I still think that's the right thing to do. It's the reason why it failed last time is because it wasn't included in our trade agreements, and Canada and Mexico came back and legally could challenge it because we hadn't included that in the trade agreements. Canada understands how important it is. So does Mexico, because that's one of the reasons why they argue against it. They know that if people could tell where the beef is coming from, they may very well choose beef that's produced in the United States. Canada, though, can advertise a Canadian beef. They can advertise, you know, Canadian bacon as an example, and they can do the same thing. But American people deserve to know where their beef is coming from.
Yeah. You mentioned price stability, and we know that inflation is slowing. But prices are still painful. They're not rising as quickly as they were. But paychecks are starting to catch up. Wages are up. Unemployment is down. That's a pretty great economic picture, even though prices are high. And that's what a lot of us make our decisions on, is when we go to the grocery store or when we go to the pump or we go to the store, we notice that pain. The Fed has been pretty patient up until now. Do you think it's time for them to cut interest rates?
Well, there's two parts to it. The Federal Reserve, if they cut interest rates, the only thing that they can really impact is the demand side of the inflation factors. And this is the part that I argue with the chairman on a regular basis in front of the committee, and that is that there's got to be a recognition that this administration's policies have added to the inflationary trends. First of all, by on a partisan basis, putting more money into the economy early on as an additional what they believed was a necessary part to come out of the pandemic itself. A lot of us disagreed, and we felt that that would heat the economy on the demand side. Now, that part the Federal Reserve can impact by increasing interest rates, making it more difficult to borrow money or less desirable to borrow money. But the other side of the equation challenge is the supply side. And that is that there is an inelastic portion to purchases that has to be recognized. Folks are going to buy gasoline to get to work, even though the price of gas has risen by over 48% since Joe Biden took office. He did that on day one when he sent a message to the investors out in the world by saying, look out, because if you're investing in pipelines, I can kill a $2 billion project with the stroke of a pen. And his focus was he wanted to see energy coming from alternative sources. He's made it extremely difficult to get oil permits on federal land. A lot of the production right now is coming off of private land, but the federal lands have been restricted. Alaska is a really good example of that. And in doing so, the price of gas is up almost, well, it's up 48% higher than when he came into office. That supply side, people still have to buy gas. And even if it costs them more, they still have to do it. That's the reason why the affordability factor is not just based on demand side, it's also based on supply side issues. People are still going to eat. Even if groceries are up over 21%, they're still going to go down and they're still going to buy eggs. They're still going to buy bread. They're still going to buy milk. It just simply hurts them, and that's coming out of their paychecks. So for me, when I talk to the Fed, I understand that on the demand side, they're getting close to the point where they could reduce interest rates on it. But what they can't impact is the supply side that this administration has, I believe, accidentally done because they didn't realize just what a big impact it would have on inflation when they started going after traditional energy sources. And in doing so, they didn't fix the rest of the supply side chain that really has hurt the American public.
I spoke with Senator Mike Rounds last week.
She's all alone, bad to the bone. Tell me what is the catch? Then I looked in her eyes. That devilish glaze before I realized too late. Trapped by a Medusa.
You are listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. That was a bit of Medusa, one of the latest releases by Denim. Don't look her in the eyes. You know better. He's a Midwest lyricist and performer, but really a nationwide musician as well. And it's been such a delight to follow your career thus far. And I'm happy to have you back in the studio. Welcome.
Happy to be back.
We're here in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio, I should say. And what's new? Just a few things.
Yeah.
Coming off some big weekend performances and then heading out to Sturgis. Let's start there with some of the shows that you've been doing.
Yeah, I've done a couple back in South Dakota the past couple weeks. We did the Levitt and the Wiley's Block Party out here, and then we're heading the West River to do the Sturgis at the Iron Horse out there. And it was good to be home for a few weeks. I've been traveling a ton this summer, but it's exhausting a little bit.
Exactly. How do you take care of your physical self for those artists just getting started? As you get bigger and bigger and more popular, there's more demands on your time, right?
Yeah.
How do you take care of you but yet
get your music out there because the opportunities, you want to take advantage of them.
I mean, some opportunities you just can't miss, you know. Other ones you got to weigh out whether if it's worth it or not to wear you out, you know, because your energy and you being there and being physically, like being present both physically and mentally while you're there is like crucial to a lot of situations, you know. And so fortunately enough, I'm at the position in my life where I have the power to say no to some things. So like,
yeah,
that's been very fortunate. So I can choose to be like, this seems like it'd be more worth the time, you know?
Yeah. It looks when I watch you perform like you are drawing energy from the crowd, but also in my imagination, I would think the crowd is like driving that energy too. So tell me what does an audience mean? Like I'm always fascinated by this. I ask a lot of people this question and their answers are all different, which I also find fascinating. But when you're in, what's the relationship with the audience like for you?
Yeah, it kind of depends on if I'm somewhere where they know me or somewhere they don't, you know? And sometimes like where I'm at, you know, you go to places and people will know your songs and know you, then sometimes you'll be at a stage where nobody's even heard of you, but it's like a big stage and you're like, so those days it's like, it's a little more work than others, I guess. But like, I think as long as they can feel the energy that you're giving off, you know what I mean? That's like reciprocated, like showing like, if you're like really caring about it and you're passionate about what you do, like then the energy starts moving in a uphill direction, you know?
Yeah. You collaborate with so many different artists, which is exciting, and a lot of Midwestern artists, which gives you a sound that is across the spectrum. Often there's no one Denim song. If you liked Medusa, the next song is going to be totally different. But it's always you because your vocals, I would say. Tell me how you choose collaboration, and how you bring yourself to the collaboration while leaving room for, you know, the person that you want to work with, frankly.
Well, I try to find others. I mean, because like not a ton of the industry is in South Dakota, so I try to find others that are nearby that can help, you know, elevate myself as well as like I could help with them in some certain ways. And a lot of this kind of business drives, it's like, okay, this person can, you know, we can do a few shows together in their market, in our market, or we can collaborate, you know, and combine followings to release music. And so there's a lot of factors that come into play. But I think being versatile just allows yourself more opportunities. But I'm just never somebody who's ever like just listened to one genre of music or like, you know, put myself in the box like that. I just kind of do what I feel in the moment, what's in my heart. And it just comes out different every time, you know.
Yeah. Your most recent LP is emotional, and there's a lot of your heart in it. Not everything that you write is autobiographical, but there's passion behind the lyrics, love, anger, fear, joy. It's all in there. When you're writing music and you're writing lyrics, what themes do you return to again and again that are worth your time, really?
It kind of depends on how I'm feeling, but I feel like as an artist, your duty is to capture an emotion, right, of whatever you're trying to give. It can be happy, it can be sad, it can be mad, it can be whatever, but you got to capture that, and when you capture it, you got to capture it in its entirety, because music paints time, and you're allowed to basically take a piece of time and put it in a little box and then open it up again later, you know? In the moment, it definitely does take away from the emotion you're feeling. And that can be a good thing or a bad thing, because you can be really happy and it makes you a little less happy. You can be sad and it makes you a little less sad, which is good. But the importance is to make sure that you can encapsulate your entire emotion, like your smells, your, you know, what you see, what you hear, and try to put that into a song. That way, when somebody else listens to you, they can really relate. But also, when you come back to it later, you're allowed to feel that again, you know?
Yeah. Do you get feedback from fans who like a particular song because, you know, once you release it into the world, it becomes part of their lived experience too? Do they give you that kind of feedback?
Yeah, it's like once you release it, it's kind of no longer yours, you know? But the feedback, it comes in different ways, shapes and forms. The most powerful feedback I've ever gotten was people that have messaged me and said, like, yo, you saved my life today, you know, like a song did. And that's like super powerful. But then also sometimes when I'm marketing, I encourage negative feedback as well as positive feedback, just to kind of play the game and feed the algorithm, you know. So I'll encourage people to talk a little smack and kind of hate on it a little bit. But it doesn't really bother me, but it helps with marketing.
I love that. I hate Elvis, branding, I think.
Right.
I love that.
And they try so hard, too.
Have you ever taken any of that native feedback and gone, they have a point, I should think about that? Or is it all just sort of comic relief in some ways?
It's a little both, you know what I mean? Yeah. I got a good sense of humor, so sometimes, a lot of times, it makes me laugh a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. Other times, it can be a perspective that I haven't thought about, you know. But, you know, it's just an interesting world on the internet, you know.
Yeah. All right, let's wrap up with helping people find your music. We'll put links up on our website at sdpb.org. But any upcoming shows or albums or, social media places you want to direct people to?
Yeah, just give me a follow on any social media platform at my name 3 times, Denham, Denham, Denham. That's a Denham. So that name 3 times. And should be basically anywhere you look. If you listen to music on whatever platform you listen on, yeah. Just Denham should be the first one that pops up wherever you go, if you like. So
thanks for stopping by and sharing a little more. We'll catch up with you later.
I appreciate you, Larry.
W.H. Illingworth was an early wet plate photographer. He initially accompanied an expedition to Montana Territory in 1866, and later he was part of the Black Hills Expedition of 1874. During that trip, he took several shots of the region, and his photos are now celebrating their 150th anniversary. Matthew Reitzel is a photo archivist with the South Dakota State Archives and Historical Society, and he's joining us now via Zoom. Matthew, welcome back. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Lori, as always. I appreciate it.
I think a lot of people are familiar with the Illingworth photographs, and we could certainly spend hours talking about the promise and the problems and the consequences of the expedition itself. But I want to focus today on the photos. How did they end up coming into the possession of the South Dakota State Archives and Historical Society? Take us back, if you would.
So one of the most important involved with that process was a man named Edward Bromley. And he was a Minnesota journalist and photographer. And in 1900, he purchased a number of slides from Illingworth's son. And when he purchased those, he kind of said, you know, we need to have these go to public organizations where people would be able to see them in the future. And he donated a number of Illingworth plates to the Minnesota Public Library and also to the Minnesota State Historical Society. Most of the images that Illingworth took were from Minnesota, but there were a few collections of plates specifically from this 1874 expedition that Bromley wrote to Doan Robinson in September of 1919. Robinson was the state historian, and the letter basically said, hey, I'm sure you know of this. There was this photographer named Illingworth. He went through the Black Hills. Are these a collection of images that you would like to have for the South Dakota State Archives? And Robinson said, certainly he would like to have them. And we have the correspondence between Bromley and Robinson in our collections as well. And basically Robinson's reply was, we would like to purchase them, but could you wait until July 1st of 1920, which every state employee would recognize as being the next fiscal year. And Bromley sold them to Doan Robinson for $60, and that's how they became part of the historical society's collection. The glass plates are kind of looked over by the state archives, and then the box that the plates were in, that Illingworth took with him from Fort Abraham Lincoln near Bismarck through the Black Hills over 2 months, 880 miles, and then came back to Fort Abraham Lincoln again. The plates in the box, boxes in the museum, and the plates are with the state archives.
Wow. How well preserved were they? When you look at them today, what are you happy that happened as far as the preservation back then?
Yeah. So one of the things with this process, and, you know, today, Lori, we have this ubiquity of photography. Everyone can take a photo at almost any time, mm-hmm. in any place. I could take a photo of myself doing this interview, but back in the 1860s, 1870s, it was a difficult process to do. There was a definite science behind it. There was this long process, and it was an art. I've seen this process done in real life, and there is an art to it. And these glass plates, they're 4.5 by 8 inches in size, and a lot of them, most of them, are stereo views. And they were all kind of the rage in Illingsworth Day to make these stereo view images. You would take the image once it was developed, put it in a specific holder, and then when you look through it, there's kind of a trick to the eye with it, and you can see this three-dimensional image from the photograph. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a trick of the eye. And when I looked at Illingworth's photographs, and when you see them on the South Dakota Digital Archives, they were put online in 2015, you can see these, there'll be this boulder in the foreground, or this tree that's just kind of sitting there, and you're like, why would this photographer take this image where he's standing? Why didn't he just move over a little bit more and this rock or tree wouldn't be there? But he did that so that when you were doing this stereo view process, that rock would, or that tree would stand out in the foreground, which would then lend itself to the rest of that three-dimensional image. And with the, with that chemical process of creating the photograph, there's just tremendous detail in glass plates that you don't get with regular photography. Author and photographer Paul Horsted has put out a number of books over the years about the Illingworth photographs, and he's gone to the locations where they are, you know, where you can see them today from the same point of view. And we recently did some higher resolution scans for his book, and because of the plates, of how they're made, you can just see a tremendous amount of detail from those high resolution scans. So it's somewhat hard to describe, but it's just it's an amazing process, in that they've lasted 150 years, and hopefully they'll last another 150 years in the Historical Society's collections.
Thanks to people like you, because the research, and we're coming up on the end of our show today, but the research is not done. And the fact that the archives has this preserved, new historians can come and look and use these plates for the next, you know, the next book, the next story, the next understanding, answering the next question. You can also view the Illingworth glass plates on the South Dakota Digital Archives, but our guest for now has been Matthew Reitzel, the photo archivist with the South Dakota State Archives and Historical Society. Let's have you on again in the future. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
And that is our show for today. We hope that it serves you. On tomorrow's In the Moment, what does it mean to have an authentic and effective social media presence when you are a teacher? To post or not to post? That is the question on this week's Teacher Talk. Plus, it has been 5 years since the Arc of Dreams took the leap of faith across the Big Sioux River. South Dakota artist laureate Dale Lamphere joins us. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.